We're following breaking news as we come on tonight. The major escalation in the Middle East. U.S. officials confirming that Iran has launched drones and missiles toward Israel, following through on its vow to retaliate for the deadly bombing of its consulate in Syria 12 days ago.
As Israel's cabinet weighs its options in response to Iran's airborne attacks, allies in Washington, London, Paris, and beyond are holding their breath, hoping a chorus of calls for restraint are heeded in Israel and any retaliation is measured. 6 months into a bloody conflict in Gaza, the Middle East has reached a perilous moment. Can the Biden administration, or perhaps a new Trump administration, act to prevent Iran from wielding nuclear as well as conventional power? Welcome to Power Play from Politico, where we talk to some of the world's most influential people on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm Anne McElvoy, and my guest this week knows how to oil the gears in Washington, London, and Brussels. Kim Darroch has been at the heart of power for several decades, as British ambassador in Washington during Trump's first 2 years in office, previously as the UK's national security advisor, and as the UK's representative to the EU. We'll also be joined by our own expert, Nihal Tuzi, Politico's senior foreign affairs correspondent in Washington, for her expert eye on events across the Middle East.
The most important call that Netanyahu could probably get right now is from Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. And if the U.S., for instance, can convince bin Salman, who has his own way of doing things, to tell Netanyahu, dude, put a lid on this, slow this down, take the win, then that could affect all sorts of things going forward.
First, Kim, Lord Darroch, welcome to Power Play.
Thank you very much.
We'll come on to how Washington is dealing with what is clearly an evolving situation in the Middle East. But I want to take us back a decade or so since you were advising David Cameron when he was in Downing Street rather than Foreign Secretary for the UK, and you were contending then with the rise of Daesh, ISIS in Iraq and Syria, with Russian aggression in Ukraine and the nuclear threat from Iran, all of these manifesting themselves in various ways and in many ways escalated today. How do you calibrate the situation now as opposed to then?
It seemed quite dangerous back in 2012 to 2015 when I was National Security Advisor. And as you mentioned, as you listed some of the issues around then, I thought to myself with some regret that although we all worked extraordinarily hard on them at the time, you couldn't say that we'd really resolved any of them. And the way it feels now is actually the world feels in a worse, more fragile, more precarious place than it did even back then. And it felt quite fragile back then. So it's been a really tough decade and, it's not getting better.
How concerned are you that important red lines have been breached in the past weeks? It's a highly unusual move for Israel directly attacking that diplomatic compound in Damascus, it says, for its own defence and security reasons. That then provoked the retaliation, which has seen an unprecedented role for the US and others, including the UK, scrambling there to Israel's defence. People might be a bit confused. Do red lines apply here? Or is this an area where we're really into uncharted territory and it's really a matter of judgment?
Well, it is, you're absolutely right, completely different and a real measure of escalation for the Iranians to do what they have just done with the launch of those hundreds of drones and missiles at Israeli territory, direct from Iranian territory. What the Israelis did with that attack, and I assume it was them, on the compound in Syria, was in itself a sort of escalation of some of the things, but they've done lots of things like that. I mean, lots of action in places like Syria or against Hezbollah leaders or whatever. This was, against described as Iranian diplomats, IRGC officers there. So it was, in a sense, an escalation anyway, but nothing like as big an escalation, if you like, as this Iranian attack launched from Iranian soil. So we are in uncharted territories, and it feels exceptionally dangerous once one country is actually attacking from its own territory, another country's territory. Then you really are in a dangerous place. And I can understand why the Israelis are saying, will we have to respond to it? But it's terribly difficult to calibrate this kind of thing, Anne, as you know. And whatever the Israelis might think as a measured response, whenever it is, may not look like that to the other side. So it's really dangerous.
Do you think Benjamin Netanyahu will, in President Biden's words, take the win and, in essence, say, well, honour is satisfied, whatever else might be telegraphed to the outside world? Or do you think that we are really in the territory of strikes on military facilities, or indeed directly to address that nuclear capability in Iran? Many people in Israel would like to see that dealt with.
Yeah, I mean, personally, not that this will count to Prime Minister Netanyahu, I think he should take the win. David Cameron has said something very similar, and I think it is the right advice. And by the way, we're in a different position, I think, than we've been for a long while, in that the RAF actually took down some of those drones. So they played a material part in defending Israel in the last 24, 48 hours. So that does, I think, give us a bit more of a basis, a bit more of a foundation, which to say you really should listen to us and you really should take the win on this and not escalate further.
Just to press you on that, yes, indeed, we've seen the RAF involved there, and clearly there's British military capability in the background alongside, obviously, the US as the much greater scale partner. Do you think that the government's got its tone right on that? Because some people say, well, if you lecture Israel, particularly in this traumatized state after the Hamas attacks, after it's on under such pressure over its actions in Gaza, actually you turn the government there even more against you. Mr. Netanyahu, which we know can be quite stroppy when it suits him, will just say, I don't really care.
I don't think Netanyahu likes being told by Europeans in particular what his policies should be. But I do think it makes a real difference to him and to Israelis in general if you actually do something to help to defend Israel beyond just words of support and rhetoric about how appalling, for example, 7th of October was. So I wouldn't claim that UK-Israel relations have been in brilliant shape over the past two or three months, ever since David Cameron in particular has started to put more pressure and to raise to ratchet up his language on the ground operation in Gaza. But I do think what we did in helping to confirm the complete ineffectiveness of this Iranian attack will have made a difference and will have been recognised by Israel. Because I just think that's the thing that's fundamental to them.
You work closely with David Cameron, obviously, in his time in power. And do you think he's calibrated correctly, or do you think he's overstepped in a tone which may seem to some in power or close to power in Israel to be lecturing them? What is your own take on that?
I mean, I'm not a huge fan of everything our current government does across the board to understate things, but I do think that David Cameron has got this right. And I do think it was right, given what was going on in Gaza, given the difficulty of getting aid into a population that was on the brink of starving, given the, according to the Palestinians, 30,000 plus casualties, civilian casualties in Gaza. I think it was necessary and right for him to speak in the way that he did, and I think he spoke with clarity and authority on this. Of course, there will be people in Israel who resented the tone, but Israel is a very divided society, and there are quite a lot of Israelis who would have supported him as well. I also think, by the way, although you can debate whether the gamble paid off, that him going off to see Trump in Mar-a-Lago and talking to the Republicans in the way that he did about their blocking of the $60 billion aid package to Ukraine was a good thing to do. So I like the tone that David Cameron is adopting.
What are the options then really available now to Israel's allies? G7 foreign ministers, meeting in Italy, talk of sanctions, top of the list. We had a really interesting discussion internally in our news conference about this at the start of the week, whether this was largely symbolic or was effectively sanctioning people who were never going to go to the place where the sanctions would apply to them anyway. Diplomats often say that symbols make a difference, but haven't we really run towards the end of our toolkit on what to do in these scenarios, short of people pushing for more muscular military action?
Yeah. I mean, I think on, I mean, you raised a minute or two ago the options in front of Israel, and they range from doing not very much or doing something in the whole cybersecurity field up to, as you said, doing something about the Iranian nuclear program. And I'm sure the Europeans will be at the bottom end of that scale. Everything I hear about from coming out of Israel at the moment suggests that both the war cabinet and the Israeli military want to go further up the scale towards something more kinetic, shall we say. And I think that gets very, very hard to calibrate in a way that doesn't come across the Iranians as another major escalation. But I think, you know, I'm not sure sanctions, I agree with you, I'm not sure sanctions have much mileage left in them now. Whatever happens, whatever the Europeans were to say, I don't think that's going to be the option that the Israelis will choose. By the way, we talk about this as if it might be something that happened in the next 24, 48 hours, and it might be, but it could be something that's a few weeks or further down the line.
Let's remind our audience of it. Famous or infamous cable of yours that was leaked, in which you said, we don't really believe the administration is going to become substantially more normal, less dysfunctional, less unpredictable, less faction-driven, less diplomatically clumsy and inept. They were words that probably popped in Politico coverage as elsewhere. And you questioned whether Trump's White House will ever look competent. The Abraham Accords are one area in which there was continuity, is continuity, of policy, which you could also say on China. We haven't seen a markedly different President Biden policy towards China. In fact, you could say quite a lot of people on the left of center or in the center saying, you know, actually, Donald Trump had a point. We needed to change the way we trade with China, and our relationship with China had become too supine. So I suppose it's like teasing out of you whether you give him more of the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I'm not sure I did underestimate him, because my reporting, and some of it was in that letter that leaked, said what an extraordinary campaigner, what a kind of extraordinary political force he was. And the loyalty that he attracted from his base was exceptional, certainly from almost any politician I've seen in my lifetime. So I think I recognized then the momentum that he had gathered, the adoration he attracted from his supporters, and the attractiveness, at least for a while, of the sort of policy prescriptions he's offering. And if you look at what's happening now in the US election campaign, I mean, all of those factors are still there. So I think I always recognized that this guy was a unique and massive political force. But I think a lot of his ideas about things were and are wrong. And part of that is his conduct of trade policies. But I also think it was a mistake to destroy the agreement we had with Iran. I think it's very hard to argue that we're in a better place as the West with Iran now than we were when the JCPOA existed.
We'll hear more from Lord Darak and Politico's very own senior foreign affairs correspondent Nihal Tuzi in Washington about what a Trump presidency might mean for the rest of the world and where the Iran-Israel crisis leaves international diplomacy in just a moment. Joining us from Washington is Nihal Tuzi, Politico's senior foreign affairs correspondent, as an expert on the Middle East. She, of course, keeps a very close eye and a sharp pen on events. Nihal, Israel, America, and others have long pointed the finger at Tehran for sponsoring Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis in the Red Sea. Does the Iranian regime really want a major war, or is it prepared to risk one in the situation that I've just been talking about there with the former ambassador?
My sense is that the Iranians really do not want a major war. If they had wanted one, they probably wouldn't have given as much signaling about the attack that they recently carried out on Israel. And also, they probably would have gotten involved earlier in the Gaza war and in a more overt way. They actually very much made it clear through messages that they did not want this to get any bigger, but they also felt like they had to respond to Israel's strike on what they said was a diplomatic facility in Syria that ended up killing several of their top Iranian military commanders. So it's, in a way, the ball's right now in Israel's court as to where this goes next.
Until a few days ago, the international focus was on the rift between President Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu over the dreadful conditions created by Israel's blockade of Gaza, much loss of life and threat and actuality of famine. How much more room for manoeuvre do you see Netanyahu having now? Because at the same time as he has the Gaza conflict, which we really shouldn't let out of our minds at this point, the focus domestically and internationally is, like it or not, on this danger of war with Israel. What's the balance of these two things? I'd like to hear from you both on that, if I could.
Well, I can tell you that, you know, there is a sense that among many observers of this crisis that the longer that Israel is on war footing, the stronger Netanyahu feels and thinks he can stay in power and that he really wants to stay in power. Now, my sense is that the United States can very much and is very much determined to keep the Gaza issue on a separate track from the Iran issue. They want the Iran issue. They want both issues resolved as quickly as possible, but they definitely want the Iran issue resolved as quickly as possible. But they also feel like even if they stand with Israel against Iran, no matter what happens, that still, it does not mean that they're going to go easy on Israel when it comes to Gaza and improving the humanitarian situation there for Palestinians. And, you know, insisting that there be a better plan for Rafah. So they are keeping those things separate. And so Netanyahu is going to continue to feel pressure. And let's not forget, an Israel-Iran war has massive global implications. So there are a lot of interested parties that want that not to happen. And whereas Gaza is a more localized conflict.
And I'm wondering, Kim, whether you see it similarly, but also bring a bit of your tradecraft to this, if you could. Nahal is suggesting that it is likely that these sort of issues will be handled separately. Clearly, they're conjoined, but that the administration and other Western governments can kind of hold them apart. But is that true when you're actually in post, when you're the ambassador who has to walk into that key meeting? You have to lead with the subject. It's pretty clear at the moment that you're going to be leading on Israel and Iran and those risks. Does it inevitably mean that the pressure over Gaza lessens?
I'm not sure it does. I mean, I agree with everything that's been said about where the Iranians are and the Iranians not wanting a direct conflict with Israel. I thought it was very striking that there was that one sentence that they issued after this launching all the drones and missiles, saying, you know, we now regard this matter as concluded, or words to that effect. And, you know, that seemed to me really quite, in a way, an un-Iranian thing to say, especially when it turned out to be such a public failure, with almost none of their missiles or drones actually hitting anything. So if you're walking in to talk to a senior Israeli now, yes, you would have to start on Iran, and yes, you would have to say, look, take the win. And if you absolutely aren't going to take the win, then for goodness sake, be very careful what you do, because if you get your calibration wrong, then you will get an Iranian reaction to this, and then who knows where we get to, because, you know, both sides will be accusing the other side of escalating. But in a sense, what you're saying to them is, take the win on this and, you know, leave it at where you've got to, but you've still got to also, on Gaza, you've got to make sure that the humanitarian stuff is getting in much, much larger quantities. And we want this ground operation over quickly, because you've already, according to the Palestinians, got 33,000 casualties or whatever it is. So I think, you know, there's a consistency in those two things, saying, actually, you've accomplished all you're really going to accomplish in Gaza. You've had a public victory on by shooting down the Iranian drones. You've shown the effectiveness of your defences. You know, this has been, a moment when you can claim a certain amount of take the win, as it were. And now it's the time to move on to what must follow this ground operation in Gaza and to calming things down in the region. Because Israel is a very powerful military in the region, but can they really cope with, you know, escalation with Iran, trouble with Hezbollah on the Lebanon border, continuing trouble in Gaza, maybe unrest in the West Bank, and who knows what else can go on with the Houthis still, you know, attacking shipping in the Red Sea. You know, how many fronts can Israel cope with at one moment?
Is that your view as well, Nahal, and I wonder if you could just perhaps slightly channel the opposing view, which is, as soon as you use the word escalation, it usually means something bad. I mean, lots of people used it about Ukraine, but sometimes there was a case for escalating the involvement in Ukraine or the pushback against the Russian invasion. What are you hearing in terms of reasonable opinion that says, look, if not now, when? You know, we have Iran getting closer and closer to the day when it is a serious nuclear as well as other kinds of military threat. It's given us a bit of an outing this week, a show and tell, son and lumiere of its drones and other performance. There could be a case for, in inverted commas, escalating. What would you make of that argument?
I think if you can escalate and it solves the problem, then maybe that works. But I don't see a lot of scenarios here in which Israel could escalate and it doesn't create another problem or more problems. Iran is well aware that Israel wants to, for example, take out its nuclear sites or somehow end them. And it has gone to great lengths to hide many of them and to take steps to protect them. So, you know, when I ask the administration, like, are you telling Israel not to do anything? You know, I'm told, look, we can't really, that's not really how it works, these kinds of discussions. But there's very much a strong sense, you know, within the Biden team that they really would like this to stop. And it's also worth remembering two other things. One is Israel has a lot of internal political turmoil still right now. There's a lot of unhappiness with the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and some of the moves he's made. There's a lot of divisions within Israeli society. But, you know, also there's a lot more at stake here about regional stability. The efforts to build a detente with Saudi Arabia, to have regional integration, all of these other things could be at risk if there is a big war between Israel and Iran. And some would argue, I mean, there are some hawks who will say we have to have this war in order to get to the peace. But there are plenty of others who would prefer not to do that.
Don't you think it would be difficult for Netanyahu, who's already under pressure, of course, over the fact that October the 7th was able to happen in the way that it did anyway, and other factors, the traumatized society, Gaza, getting that very mixed response in the outside world. Do you think it would be possible to resist pressure from the right of his coalition, who do want to take on Iran and do have quite some considerable public support?
I think if I was running the show, and there are reasons that I am not, the most important call that Netanyahu could probably get right now is from Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. And if the U.S., for instance, can convince bin Salman, who has his own way of doing things, to tell Netanyahu, dude, put a lid on this, slow this down, take the win, then that could affect all sorts of things going forward. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the way I would see it. The ambassador may have a different point of view.
The ambassador may well phrase it as, dude, put a lid on it.
yes, not exactly my words, but I get the sense of it. And I do agree with everything that's just been said. I would just add to it the point that Netanyahu, yes, will be under pressure from his the right wingers in his war cabinet, and maybe from parts of the Israeli media and parts of the Israeli public. But he's under pressure from both sides, so he's living in a pressure cooker at the moment. But the other people he has to listen to are the Israeli Defense Forces. And unless things have changed dramatically since my days as National Security Advisor, I mean, the idea, for example, of trying to take out the Iranian nuclear facilities, which are buried deep underground, is, in military terms, extraordinarily, maybe unimaginably difficult, and involves a kind of, you know, suicide mission, landing people on in Iranian territory with little chance of retrieving them afterwards, and then fighting your way into underground. I mean, it's just extraordinarily difficult. So one of the other voices he will be listening to is his military telling him just what is possible in these circumstances. I can't imagine his military will be saying, this would be a good moment to actually escalate with Iran because we feel in a very strong position to do some really meaningful things there. I just can't believe that.
Before we let you both get back to your day jobs, let's look to what could be that change of administration in the US. And considering the flashpoints across the world, and we've only touched on a few of them in this conversation. In fact, it'd be a very long podcast if we did the lot, because planet Earth is not in a particularly stable way at the moment. What do you think would be at the top of the to-do list if Donald Trump were to return to the White House, probably nailing the former ambassador's cable to the wall of the Oval Office? I don't suppose you're allowed to do that. But I'm having a bit of a tease here, Kim, as we know each other a little. Just what do you think first that you would expect to see from a new administration if there were one?
I think that first of all, I think for him it's all about the southern border. So I don't want to comment on, I'm not American, I don't want to comment on American domestic politics. But I think that is the thing from what I read that is most energizing his supporters, apart from the state of the economy and inflation is too high. But in terms of things he would do very quickly, I think he would do some stuff down there about closing down that border and stopping the flow across it. Internationally, look, he said, I will stop the Ukraine war in 24 hours by putting pressure on Zelensky and using my leverage with both Zelensky and with Putin to get them to do an instant deal. I myself respectfully think that's not a very credible claim to be making, but I think he would move quite quickly to tell Zelensky no more weapons from the US and tell Putin, please try and do a deal with this guy. I think he has leverage over Zelensky because of the importance of American supplies to Ukraine. I'm not sure about his leverage with Putin, to be frank. But anyway, that would be another thing that he would do.
An entirely different podcast. Well, linked, but entirely different podcast. Nihal, with your eye there on the Middle East, what would you either predict might happen or indeed fear might happen in the event of a change of government?
I actually think that the first thing Trump will do is retribution. So he's going to try to clean out the Department of Justice, go after people that he felt went after him, on the criminal front. That's going to be his number one priority. I think foreign policy will actually be a secondary priority. And when it comes to the Middle East, I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't really do anything immediately on the Middle East as his people try to figure out what's going on. The last time around, they didn't really do a lot of research. They didn't really talk to people before they took office as part of a transition. They often didn't really show up for the transition. And so when they took over, it took them some time. And I think this time we'll probably see some similar things. It might be a little different with Europe and Ukraine and Russia for him. But I think the Middle East, I don't see an immediate switch in policy from him on day one.
Well, one of the things we're hoping to explore in this kind of loose series of three explorations of changing American foreign policy and the possibility of return of Donald Trump is exactly that. We did so last week with Robert Greenway. Next week, we're hoping to have Elbridge Colby with us, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy under Donald Trump. So do listen out for that. I think we can let you both go. I'm not sure we do this one for insiders. What do we think, Peter, our producer sitting alongside me? We always ask our guests who they'd like to hear next on the show. Let's ask them both. Nihal, who would you like to hear next on the show?
Ooh,
no one gets to do this at Politico except you. But you worked for it. Go.
gosh, I think it's always fun to get Brett McGurk to do one of these. He's kind of the White House's main guy on the Middle East. So it'd be good to get his perspective.
It's good to know that even in her podcast listening downtime, Nihal Tusi is listening to the White House expert on the Middle East. That is so Politico. And I should say, Kim Darrett.
I think it's kind of sad.
I didn't want to say that. You're a very close colleague. And you do it with aplomb. It doesn't have to be right now or on this subject. But one thing we have found really interesting is who people would like to hear on Power Play. And then they've often turned out to be great guests. So, Kim Darrick, over to you. Who shall we field in the hot seat you're sitting in today?
Could I give you two options? One is...
So diplomatic.
No, because they're both just brilliant people, I think. One is Carl Bildt. His days as foreign minister are, I guess, over, although he still looks very youthful. But he is the best encapsulator of the big picture and the different forces that are creating the crises around us that I've ever come across. And he's one of the most brilliant international figures around. And the other one is David Miliband, who I worked with when he was Foreign Secretary, and who's like a kind of younger version of Carl Bildt. I just think he's a huge loss to British politics. And I would ask him, why aren't you running for a seat in the next election when Labour might win quite a lot of seats and returning to British politics, because the country needs you?
David Miliband, heed the call and give us the scoop first. Thank you very much indeed to Lord Darroch, Kim Darroch, and our very own Nahal Tuzi.
Thanks.
That was great, Anne. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Ambassador, do you think I should run everything?
I think you certainly should.
You'll have
certainly
it.
Should. It was a pleasure.
That's all for this week's edition of Power Play. Next week, I'll be talking to the man tipped to be Donald Trump's national security advisor if he returns to office, to round off our look at the foreign policy options that lie ahead for the United States, for allies and foes. We hope you enjoy our transatlantic conversation and keep listening. Perhaps give us a rate and review when you're in an especially good mood. And we'd love it if you followed the podcast too. We like to get to know you and hope you're enjoying getting to know us. The team behind this podcast is Peter Snowden, senior producer in London, the executive producer in Berlin, Christina Gonzalez. And thanks this week too to Dionys Sturis, giving me a wave on screen, Politico's senior producer in Brussels. I'm Anne McElvoy, and thank you for listening.